From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. She was a first, but she just couldn't make it last. Acting Massachusetts Governor Jane Swift today announced she would not seek the Republican nomination for governor after a stormy tenure in the corner office.
I have never done anything in my life without giving it 100%. And the reality that I'm sure there isn't a working parent in America that hasn't faced it, that when the demands of the two tasks that you take on both increase substantially, something has to give.
Swift was the first female to serve as governor in Massachusetts and drew national attention when she became the first governor in the country to give birth in office. But with it all came questions about her political judgment and parental juggling. Critics vilified her for using staff for babysitting, and then there was the famous copter ride to make it home to Western Massachusetts for Thanksgiving. But were they too swift in judging her, holding her up to impossible standards no one would dare measure a man against? Or was she just not up to the job? In this hour, gender politics, hard choices, and hard ball, we begin this conversation with a politician who knows firsthand about the trials of combining motherhood, womanhood, and politics. Pat Schroeder served 24 years in the U.S. Congress. In 1987, she considered running for president, only to bow out in tears on national TV. Earlier, I asked the former congresswoman what she makes of Jane Swift's decision to step aside and whether sexism is alive and well in American politics.
I do believe sexism is alive in politics. It doesn't mean that that's the total thing, but I honestly think if you look at her career and look at many of the things that she got criticized for roundly, had she been male, people would have said, isn't that nice? You know, what a good father. Very, very interesting, and it's just too bad. But you know what? I also predict she'll be back. I mean, she's young. She'll be back. Give her a few years.
Well, Tip O'Neill, of course, famously said all politics is local, and there's clearly a powerful local story here loaded with local politics that may or may not have anything to do with gender. But do you see this, Pat Schroeder, as part of a national story, too, about women and politics in America?
Yes, I think so. I think women find that the bar is always much higher for them for some reason. Look, I don't have to talk about your poor governor and talk about myself. I shed a few tears when I pull out of the race, and you would have thought I'd had a total nervous breakdown when I was looking at running for president. And people just went nuts. Now, if you look, I've been keeping a crying file ever since, and it's like there's no male candidate that dare runs without crying, you know, and isn't that wonderful? He's showing compassion. So
it's de rigueur for the male, but it's off limits to the woman. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. I think there's a lot of things like that. And I really encourage people to stop and think, how would they react to that if that happened, you know, to a male?
Well, we've surely seen plenty of males teary-eyed at different kinds of political announcements, and Jane Swift was certainly teary-eyed today, but it looked a little different. It looked as though she was feeling that she was up against something she couldn't get past, something bigger than politics here.
That's very true. I think, first of all, her party wasn't very supportive. To have a primary against an incumbent sitting governor is brutal. It's really brutal. It doesn't happen very often, and especially it doesn't happen in the Republican Party because they're much more disciplined than we are as Democrats. So that's pretty shocking, and it clearly says they're just kind of not putting their wagons in a circle and trying to protect her. They're letting her hang out there and take all the arrows.
But Jane Swift's numbers, polling numbers, were pretty lousy compared to Mitt Romney's, a very successful businessman with a lot of money and the Winter Olympics behind him. He showed up on the horizon, and within a matter of weeks, her numbers were in the basement. He was soaring, and the story was all but over.
Yes. Well, part of the reason her numbers were in the basement was, I think, sure, some of it was her fault and ineptness as a new politician. Some of it, though, I think really can be attributed to the sexism that's still remaining out there against women. You know, we can't decide what we want women to do. If they stay home and take care of their family, then we say they really should be out working and helping provide for their family. If they're helping provide for their family, we say they really should feel guilty that they're not home taking care of their family. So there's nothing you can do that's right. That's reflected in the political arena. And her party never helped her fend any of that off. they just kind of stood there and let her defend herself. What happened to the camaraderie? And what happened to, you know, everybody standing together? You either have some support or you don't, and it looks like she didn't have a lot.
Well, that's a question, isn't it? Even within a party, does camaraderie extend to female political candidates in the way that camaraderie extends to males?
You want my direct answer?
Well,
my
please, Pat.
My direct answer is no. Never has, never will. Maybe it will someday. I hope I live long enough to see it. But I think women are still looked upon like little boys used to look upon the girl who broke into their treehouse. It's like, ugh, she's here. Now what are we going to do? It's not a supportive, welcoming, friendly environment.
Mm-hmm. And yet, when you look out across the country today, there are more women in political positions than ever. The U.S. Congress has more women than ever. That looks like progress, Pat Schroeder.
Yes, but it's very incremental progress. I got elected in 1972, and there were 15 women. It's now in the 60s. Yippee skippy. I mean, if anybody had told me then it would be that slow, I would have never believed it.
Mm-hmm.
We have all of 13 women in the U.S. Senate. That's 13%. It's the 21st century, for heaven's sakes. There are many countries that have much higher representation than we do.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, we're making progress and going in the right direction, but you're not going to get a nosebleed from the speed, I'll tell you.
Is there a particular lesson in Jane Swift's story for women of childbearing age? She was famously very pregnant right in the midst of governing Massachusetts. What does her body blow, her fall from grace today, say to other women in their late 20s, their 30s, their early 40s, thinking about both motherhood and a political career? Are these just not compatible?
Well, I think they are compatible. When I got elected, I had a 2-year-old and a 6-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
But it is very difficult. At that time, progressives had decided that women could work outside the home if they didn't have a family. So we're a long way away from really accepting women who have a young family in the same manner we accept men who have a young family. And so we've got a long way to go, and I think that's what the message is today.
Well, what would you say to Jane Swift today? She's clearly not feeling at the top of her game.
Well, I would say to her not to worry about it. Go home, have a wonderful time with the kids. When you really feel you kind of got that under control, you've had real trial by fire, come back and run again for something. Don't give up that great experience. And she has made tremendous progress, because there's going to be many people that sit down today and think, did we really treat her totally fairly the whole time? Did the party treat her in a supportive manner? Were there things that could have been done? And that's how you make progress. It's very sad that somebody has to go out there and bang the door down first, but somebody always does.
Pat Schroeder is a former congresswoman from Colorado. She spoke to us from Washington. We're talking about the sharing of political power between men and women. Is gender still a burden for women in political combat? Or is competency what it's all about in the hearts and minds of voters? Does the Jane Swift saga tell a bigger story about women in politics? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Needham, Massachusetts, is Joan Vinaki, columnist at the Boston Globe. She's a longtime political observer and recently wrote an editorial or column entitled Swift's GOP Foes Make It All About Gender. Good evening and welcome, Joan Vinaki.
Well, hi, and you know I didn't write the headline, right?
We know, but we're going to dive into that column, Joan. It's great to have you with us. And with us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is On Point news analyst and Atlantic Monthly senior editor Jack Bedew. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Joan, for our listeners here in Boston and around the country, where do you come down on the Jane Swift story? Is this about political ineptitude or gender bias or a mix? What's the balance here, Joan?
Well, I think it's a mix, but when you were talking earlier, you talked about sharing political power. And to me, a key theme out of this whole saga is how much men do not want to share political power, or how, you know, they just, from the get-go, the establishment just worked very hard against her.
So make the case that this was more about men not wanting to share power with a woman than it was about a young, relatively inexperienced politician who just wasn't up to the competition.
Okay. Well, I think that just by your description, young, relatively inexperienced politician.
Okay, so now I'm on the bad bandwagon, too. Okay, you got me.
Well, I was just going to say that if you said that it was a 37-year-old man versus a 37-year-old mm-hmm. woman, mm-hmm. that the age alone has a different connotation, man versus woman. You know, I always say that a woman is either too young or too old. That never seems to be a problem for men.
There's no operating room in the middle.
Right. Men are never too young to mm-hmm. go for a job, and they're certainly never too old. They're mm-hmm. never too seasoned. Women just get wrinkled and old. So, you know, just the descriptive things. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not going to sit here and argue that she was the brightest political light that ever lit up a scene.
And yet this was no fool. Jane Swift managed to maneuver through political waters for years here.
I think she was a smart, articulate woman who made political mistakes. They weren't huge mistakes. It wasn't about corruption or dishonesty or, stealing or anything like that. There were some political missteps. Cumulatively, the press just strung them all together and painted this picture of, basically a moron. I mean, I think I was on one radio talk show not too long ago where the talk show host said she was an idiot, which, you know, to use words like that to describe a person, I mean, I guess we describe some men like that. Some people probably.
But not often and not public
but
figures.
But not often and not publicly and not across the board.
If a man, Joan.
She had no constituency behind her. Mm-hmm. Women deserted her, too.
Mm-hmm. Joan, that's interesting, and I want to come to that. But if a man had strung together the same or comparable missteps, do you think that would have added up to idiocy in the public appraisal or press appraisal?
Well, it didn't with Paul Cellucci.
This was Jane Swift's predecessor in office.
I mean, he made mistakes. The legacy of the Weld-Cellucci years is the Big Dig, is the patronage at Massport, is the mess at the Turnpike. You know, she basically inherited their legacy. She was part of their administration, so I'm not saying that she, you know, shouldn't bear responsibility for it. But somehow they've managed to walk away scot-free, and I just don't understand that. Now, I want to be clear about one thing. Politically, I don't agree with Jane Swift. You know,
okay.
On election day, I doubt that she'd have my vote, you know, depending on, you know, who the opponent is. But there's just something about the treatment that offends me. It's not that I don't think that we have the right, and I certainly questioned her on policies and wrote critical columns about her decisions on policies, mm-hmm. including this tax rollback situation. But there was just something about the tone. It just keeps on reminding me of that old Supreme Court definition about pornography. You know it when you see it. You know it when you feel it, that it's just a different tone and way of going about sort of stripping credibility from a woman.
And you'd call that gender bias. You'd call that sexism. Jack Beatty, how about you? What do you see here?
This is an especially vacuous leader. Brian McGrory in today's Globe shows why. A year ago, she was named the state's education czar by the then-governor, Paul Cellucci. She said we needed 30,000, a call for 30,000 volunteer tutors to help students pass exams. Well, Brian McGrory called several principals and asked them, any volunteers showing up? The guy says, no, obviously not. Zero. She calls the State Department of Education. How is the tutoring program going? They say, well, we can't give you a real number. This woman was all about symbolism. Cellucci picked her because she was a woman, hoping to use the symbolism. Her twins, far from being a liability, that was her political identity. I am mother, and I'm this symbol. And the whole thing has, I think, just been so cynical. And even by Massachusetts standards, this was an achievement light. Especially vacuous politician.
So you're not biting on gender bias here, Jack?
I am not at all, no.
Well, there you've got it. Between the one perception and another is the story of Jane Swift. You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. Does the Jane Swift story tell us something about the challenges facing women in politics nationally? Or was this just one Massachusetts mom who couldn't cut it in big league politics? Join us, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston,
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
From the day that I got into government, and particularly since the birth of my children, I set aside time for family that has always been non-negotiable. With that being said, something had to give, either in governing or in politics. And I believe it's extraordinarily important that we make the right decisions today on taxes, on educational policy, that lead our state out of this current fiscal crisis so that we can emerge with a strong and a bright future.
That was Acting Massachusetts Governor Jane Swift announcing today reasons why she will not seek the Republican nomination for governor. We're talking tonight about the fate of Jane Swift and what it does or doesn't tell us about the fate of American women in politics today. Are women held to a different standard, an unfair standard, or was this youngest female governor in the nation just not up to the competition? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by Joan Vinacki, a columnist at the Boston Globe, and by our own news analyst, Jack Beatty. Joan, you heard just before the break, Jack Beatty was saying this was an especially vacuous leader. No tears shed by Jack, and he says it's not gender bias. She just didn't have the right stuff.
Well, he said she was vacuous and cynical. And I don't know that you could be both, quite honestly, because to be cynical, you know, implies some sort of intelligence and, you know, willingness and ability to manipulate. And you, Tom, you also talked about what does this say about the fate of American women.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm not sure what it says about the fate of American women, but I think it says something to worry about in terms of the fate of Massachusetts women. And if I was Shannon O'Brien right now,
this is,
I'd be putting my armor on because they're
another candidate gunning for the governor's house.
Right. The guys on the Democratic side now see her as the one to get out of the race, and they've already started calling her a bully. You'll see pretty soon they'll be, you know, questioning her commitment to choice and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think their sights are trained on her right now.
Mm-hmm. Jack Beatty, so you're not prepared to go to the mat for Jane Swift, given her politics and presentation. Do you see any element of gender issues swirling around a politician you're clearly not fond of? But is there a gender element there anyway?
Yes, and it's about having a family and the constraint that is. I said that politically those twins were her ace in the hole, but they were also her burden, and I take her at her word. I mean, you cannot run a state and run for office, have two elections, a primary and then a general election, and have three small children. You know, there's a story about a leading Washington politician who ran for president in the 80s, and I heard this from a close aide. He said the politician was on the phone with a contributor, and he was talking on the phone, and the secretary called him in. He said, "Your son, 17-year-old son, is on the line and says it's urgent." And my friend said he watched that sign. He watched the blinker, you know, on the phone, and he just watched that and watched that sun on that line, minute after minute. And pretty soon the sun gave up and just stopped the call.
But Jack
that's
Beatty,
what that's what politics does to families.
But you're
it
saying
just,
you
it
can't
eats,
do it.
Eats
but,
them up.
Sure, but you remember a politician called John F. Kennedy, and he rather famously had very young children, and he was seen as a hero of political competence and aptitude.
Well, I'm saying that Jane Swift didn't want to make that sacrifice. I think that this is something that happens in politics, and it may be especially difficult for women when children are as small. I mean, she has infants, toddlers. I don't see how it could be. I have to give her due. I think she's genuinely torn here about how could she possibly be their mother and at the same time take on this double burden, two campaigns, plus running a state that's in fiscal trouble. The family is a casualty in politics, and it may be that women feel that more deeply than men.
Joan Vinacki, motherhood and politics, can they work together?
Oh, gosh, I totally, totally disagree with what Jack just said. I don't think it was the twins and the toddler that led to her decision not to run. She can't run without money and support. She can run as a mother. She can run with children. She happens to have a husband who is, you know, the primary caretaker right now. Her life, you know, I think, yes, you make choices, and yes, it was a difficult balance, but I think it was doable, and it is doable, And in the end, she made a political calculation, and I'm kind of sorry that she said it was about her family.
Mm-hmm. She laid it right there.
I do think that it was a political calculation and a pretty smart political calculation. You know, she woke up one day, probably yesterday, and just said, enough.
I've had enough.
It isn't worth it without the support, without the ability to raise money, running against a man who has $10 million at his disposal and the perfect family behind him.
Mm-hmm. There's a picture that we're used to seeing. Vicki is on the line. Welcome, Vicki. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I'd just like to make one comment, and that is that in this last bit of the conversation, mm-hmm. talking about James Swift's family.
Yes.
And Mitt Romney's family, his wife is quite ill at this point.
So this is the Republican challenger who she has ceded to, for those listeners outside Massachusetts.
Yes, and I guess I'd like to say I'm a registered Democrat. I would never vote for James Swift in a million years. But I'm sad that she gave up. I'm sad that, because I think the other half of the story is Mitt Romney, and that somehow his sort of sweeping into town and saying, gee, I'd like to be governor, is, I think, a very telling thing about the Democratic Party in this state. And I think the fact
the Democratic Party or the Republican?
About the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. And he could never, I happen to have been born and raised in Salt Lake City, Utah. He could not have run for office and won. He couldn't have been the dog catcher in Utah. So
do you see a gender line in that dynamic, Vicki?
Well, I see two things. I see definitely a power issue, and I certainly do see a gender line here. I think I would have to respectfully disagree with Mr. Beatty as well. I don't think this is. I think that family is an issue for every person who's in office, but everybody, pretty much people who are in office, have families.
So we hear you. You're disappointed she didn't duke it out with Mitt Romney. On the other hand, gosh, look at the momentum that he's built up in just these few weeks, and the poll that just came out in the Boston Herald showing him leading Swift 75% to 12% in the opinion polls. Vicki, thanks for your call. I want to turn now to Celinda Lake. Celinda Lake is president and founder of Lake Snell Perry & Associates. She's based in Washington, D.C. It's a political polling firm. She's a super strategist on electing women candidates and framing issues to women voters. Good evening and welcome, Celinda Lake.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us. Celinda, you've made a career out of promoting and getting women elected to higher office. What's your reaction to Jane Swift's announcement today?
Well, I think it is unfortunate that she framed it in terms of family. I think it is in response, a politician response to declining polling numbers and an increasingly precarious political position with the money stop, the endorsement stop, in what is a very tough state. However, I also think it reveals very much the double standard. And I think when one of the previous speakers said there's no one who runs with young children, men run with young children all the time, and voters like it. They think this is great because this person will be concerned about the future. They'll be committed to education. Women who run for young office, and there are a record number of women running for governor right now with mm-hmm. young children. But voters wonder who's going to take care of the kids. No one ever asked that about the male candidates. So it is very much still a double bind, and I think it's unfortunate that the circumstances and the visibility of her twins, et cetera, really accentuated that dimension. The second thing, I think, is that women's mistakes are more visible and often remembered, and it doesn't take as much to destroy women's candidacies, I don't think, as much as men's, and convince voters that they're incompetent.
Why is that? You've thought a lot about this. What's going on? Why is the skin thinner or the candidacy less impervious to criticism?
I think that part of it is that voters still think it's a big risk to elect a woman, particularly for executive office. It's not a natural office. They tend to see women as better in legislative offices. They're worried about women as solo leaders.
Why?
Because they're worried if they're tough enough for the job, they'll worry if the men will follow them, and they're worried if they have the skills that it takes to kind of knock heads together, get things done, make kind of macro decisions, lead a state forward in times of crisis. That kind of solo leadership, that kind of toughness, that kind of knocking heads together, which certainly a brawling state like Massachusetts needs, is not the kinds of traits that people traditionally associate with women.
So
people
do you
also think it's risky to elect a woman? So if she makes a mistake, they immediately worry about it. I mean, you know, Mitt Romney, if you'll remember, was the guy who ran, and his business practices had raised serious questions when he ran against Kennedy in terms of the people that he had hurt and some of his business decisions and their consequences.
This is when Mitt Romney ran against Ted Kennedy for a seat in the U.S. Senate and lost.
Exactly, and lost in part because of very, very serious consequences of the business decisions he had made for ordinary people's lives. As one of the previous speakers said, I mean, in the age of political corruption in Massachusetts and billion and million-dollar bad decisions like the Big Dig, or at least controversial ones, you know, $1,200 for a helicopter is child's play in Massachusetts, but everybody remembers that she took her child, took the state helicopter home to take care of her daughter one day.
So, Celinda Lake, what do you make of the big picture here? There's 60-some congresswomen now. There's 13 senators in the U.S. Senate. We had Patricia Schroeder on earlier. She said, yippee skippy. This is not the kind of numbers she expected to have at this point. What is the big trend?
Well, the big trend is that we're only making incremental gains, and we had a big breakthrough 10 years ago, which was 1992, and we haven't had a big breakthrough since then. It's been 20 years since we had a woman run for vice president. I think all of us think we can't imagine it would have taken this long. And these governors' races are the real glass ceiling. Presidents, senators, leaders of their states come from governorships, and we have a record number of women running in very tough times, and that's what's going to be the real question. Will we shatter that glass ceiling in the 2002 elections or not?
Celinda Lake, Joan Vinaki, stand by. I want to turn to the phones. Lisa's on the line. Welcome, Lisa. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks.
Well, you know, I want to turn back to a comment you made earlier in the show, which is you asked, what kind of effect does this have on women of childbearing age?
Mm-hmm.
And I really want to address that question. I am a professional woman. I'm almost the same age as Jane Swift.
Okay.
And I have two little girls who are the same ages about as her children are.
Lucky you.
And yes, I am. Very lucky. And I just feel just so sad about what happened today. Like someone else commented, I am a registered Democrat and would not have voted for Jane Swift, but really, really was very proud that she was trying to do everything that she was trying to do and felt very sad at the sacrifices it seemed like she felt she had to make.
So
for example, Massachusetts does not have a governor's mansion. Jane Swift commutes 3 hours home to her children. And yet at one point when there was a, you know, not a very definite proposal that there be a governor's mansion, she said that, no, actually, it was okay. She didn't really need one.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, why did she feel like she had to make a comment like that? Most of the other states have one, but did she feel like it would be seen as some kind of, you know, concession being made to her because of her family situation?
Lisa, we may never know, but let me ask you this. What lessons, then, do you take as a mother of comparable age about your career? Is there some kind of sharing of fate here with Jane Swift, or do you feel this was one politician's fate, not yours, not other women's?
Makes me absolutely more determined. I remember when the twins were born, USA Today ran an editorial, and the headline was, "Stay home with your babies, Governor," and it just offended me so much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it isn't just her image. Her identity isn't just a mother. Her identity is to be a mother and a terrific mother and so many other things as well. And why she felt she had to choose, I think, is a really sad day for Massachusetts.
Lisa, thanks very much for calling. Joan Vinaki, what about this motherhood issue sitting in the middle of the years when many politicians really began to rev up their careers?
Well, I'd like a little to respond to some of the callers from the women, because I think they're both hitting on something that is going to really work to the advantage of Shannon O'Brien, at least in the short term.
This is a Democratic contender in the upcoming election.
Contender. Whether or not people were for women, were for Jane Swift, there was a real feeling of sadness watching her today pull out, and it wasn't just because she, you know, got emotional. I think women watched it and felt that something sad had happened, that it was a lost opportunity, a missed opportunity, and that Democratic women, it's going to make Democratic women more determined than ever, just like that last caller said, makes her more mm-hmm. determined than ever as a professional woman. Democratic women are going to be more determined than ever to get behind Shannon O'Brien's candidacy.
And how do you see motherhood? Is it a red herring in this conversation, or, you know, is it a human fact that women are going to be especially somehow burdened with?
a red herring motherhood. I'm not sure how to respond.
Well, forgive me. Sorry, Joan. We go too far back, but you know what I'm saying. Is motherhood somehow or parenthood an impediment to young women in politics? Should it be an impediment that it's not for men?
Well, you know, I guess, you know, it's an impediment if society makes it an impediment. It's an impediment if you have to commute 3 hours to your home. But the twins really didn't factor into Jane Swift's political life, as far as I could see. We haven't even seen them since they were born. I don't, maybe you have, but I haven't.
I don't recall it.
She went home from the hospital. She, you know, took her maternity leave. And from May until now, I don't think I've ever seen her with the twins.
Mm-hmm.
I think she went to the opposite extreme because of what had happened the first time out with the infamous helicopter situation.
Mm-hmm. So they became invisible. So Linda,
maybe she would have been better off using them as a prop, you know, to put it in a cynical way.
Mm-hmm.
Men certainly use their children. Mitt Romney today had that wonderful family behind him, those sons and I assume daughters-in-laws, and, you know, he must be the best-looking grandfather around, those little baby and everything.
But he never had to struggle to the lectern with a great big pregnancy right in front of him.
That's right, but he does have a wife with a serious illness.
Mm-hmm. So, Linda Lake, I want to...
The wife said today, I will never be an impediment to Mitt. This is a woman with MS. Mm-hmm. I mean, so, you know, I think it's interesting that it's okay for a man to make that decision about a wife who's got a serious illness, but people are questioning whether or not, you know, a 37-year-old woman can be the mother of twins and a toddler and still be a governor. I don't know. It just doesn't all add up to me.
It does feel like a different standard. So, Linda Lake, I know we're going to lose you at the break. How are you counseling women looking to get into politics? What's the message? What's the face that they need to project to the electorate to make it and to stay in power? Can they just be natural and tell it like it is, or how are you advising them?
Well, I think the biggest question for women candidates is actually how do they communicate, particularly for these executive offices, that they can be effective, that they're tough enough for the job, and not lose their authenticity? How can they lose the things that women voters in particular, but all voters, find very appealing, their human qualities, their ability to relate to real people's problems, and the fact that they're more in touch with the problems that face average families, and at the same time convince voters that they can manage economy, manage a budget deficit, and knock the state legislature's head together.
Mm-hmm. And are you seeing that message picked up and used effectively by women?
Well, I think that the irony is, and Jane Swift is ironic in this regard as well, the women who actually get to this level are very accomplished and, for the most part, tough as nails. Now, Jane Swift made a lot of political mistakes, but she wouldn't be here. This isn't a run-of-the-mill woman off the street. This is a seasoned politician, despite her age. And we should remember, as another speaker pointed out, that Massachusetts has a history of some very young, very accomplished politicians. But she made a lot of mistakes, and I think makes it both probably does energize some Democratic primary women, but also raises the bar and makes it harder. And a woman is going to have to prove herself even more, particularly another woman who is the mother of young children.
Mm. It's a tough story. So Linda Lake, president and founder of Lake Snell Perry and Associates in Washington, thanks so much for joining
us
tonight.
Thank you very
much. Listeners, are American women making progress in politics or still being tied to the mommy track and run over by men? Is it all about performance now, about hard play on an even field? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston University.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the fate of acting governor of Massachusetts, Jane Swift, who today said she will not compete with Mitt Romney, a well-financed, high-flying man for the Republican Republican primary. What does it mean? What does it say, if anything, about the situation of American women in politics today? Are American women making progress in politics or still being tied to the mommy track and run over by men? And Massachusetts voters, what's your bottom line? Was this a result of a governor's political failings or gender bias on a grand scale? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Robert is on the line. Welcome, Robert. You're on the air.
Hi, John. How are you?
Fine. It's Tom. Thanks, Robert.
Oh, sorry about that. Anyways, this is really sort of curious to me. This is really Jane Swift bashing. The issue is that we should have some compassion and a great deal of respect for a future Republican politician who turned her attention back to her children in the face of a cover boy coming in from the outside who has as much substance as the firecrackers that he displayed at the Olympics.
So are you seeing this as a savvy move on the part of Jane Swift to retreat and fight another day?
I think it is a brilliant move by Jane Swift. I think that she is saying to the public she will not play. She's saying to the public she will not be bashed. She was bashed when she left her kids. She's being bashed when she's going back to them. They don't understand that the real issue here is that she didn't have a prayer, but she does have one prayer, that her children grow up healthy, that she's a good mother. She's not on a mummy track. She's going back and turning her attention, because how much energy can one human being have?
Robert, we hear your compassion and your applause, and thanks for sharing it with us. Let's turn right to another call. Laura is on the line. Welcome, Laura. You're on the air.
Good evening.
Hi.
I first just want to say that I think Ms. Vinaki is just wonderful, incisive, and I...
So do I, Laura. Hear, hear.
But what I wanted to say is that I think that Jane Swift earned our ill will, and she didn't earn the governorship or the lieutenant governorship. And
earned it with policies, not with gender.
Yeah, I think she earned it with policies, and I think when she was having the twins and there was a lot of brouhaha as to whether she should stay acting governor, I kept thinking about Jean Shaheen, and if we had heard that she, who earned her position, had got, we wouldn't have distrusted her doing
the
that.
New Hampshire governor.
Been, mm-hmm. She could have been pregnant, and it would have been fine with voters. And I also think that her decision to live 3 hours away each way, and my recollection is that it was her decision, and it had to do with her husband more and her family support out there in North Adams, not, and that she had actually offers from people that they could have an apartment or something.
So we hear you, Laura. No crocodile tears from your corner. Joan Vinaki, you mentioned earlier that women may continue, that you see women being tough on Jane Swift as well. What's that about?
Well, you know, I want to say that thank you for saying I was incisive and then disagreeing with everything I said. I think that was a brilliant move. But at any rate, in August, I actually wrote a column which started out with the lead, Surrender Dorothy. I was suggesting at the time that Jane Swift should not seek re-election, that, you know, she just wasn't in a strong political position, and that, you know, things just didn't look right for her. She decided to go ahead and run, not because of any, you know, just because of her own thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
Since that time, I have to, you know, it's like in that window from, you know, September, which of course covers September 11th, till now, that's when I just see this, you know, kind of bullying and piling up on her that made it basically impossible for her to be a leader and to govern. Her own party cut her loose. The Republicans cut her loose. Of course, the Democrats cut her loose. The business community, the business establishment didn't reach out and help.
And when finally there was nowhere to run.
When you're all alone on an island with a, you know, like an over $1 billion, you know, deficit in the budget, I just don't know, you know, how anybody could show, you know, brilliance or leadership at that point without any help from anybody else. Mm-hmm.
Joan Vinaki, columnist extraordinaire at the Boston Globe. You're the best, and we thank you for joining us this hour.
Okay, well, thanks, Tom.
Jack Beatty, last word goes to you. We can hear that this was not your favorite politician in the world, but how do you look at the gender struggle that she had to go through anyway?
Very difficult. I don't minimize that for a moment. The situation for women as candidates may actually be darkening, and that's because we're back to a warfare state. It's no coincidence that the year of the woman, 1992, was the first post-Cold War election. When you put war into the picture, that, again, I think is one of those factors that Celinda Lake was talking about that make voters think, well, we, and I'm not saying for good reason, that's just the fact, that to prefer to work against women candidates. So that's a long-term trend here that perhaps may not be all that welcoming.
Perhaps not. Jack, thanks so much for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can hear Jane Swift's press conference from earlier today. It's on our website. Log on to onpointradio.org. With the Academy Awards now just 5 days away, we continue our week-long series looking at the nominees in some of the biggest categories for 2001. Tonight, what could a schizophrenic professor, a mentally retarded father, a world heavyweight boxing champion, a bad boy cop, and a middle-class New England doctor have in common? Their roles played by the actors up for this year's Best Actor in a Leading Role. A heavy lineup and most likely a tough decision for this year's Academy. To make our way through this year's nominees' performances, we're joined by our on-point movie maven, Garen Daly, to give us the inside scoop. Welcome, Garen Daly.
Hi, Tom.
So what do you make of the men up for Best Actor this year?
I think that you said it right. It's a tough, tough year for the Academy to decide what's going on. I mean, you take a look at Tom Wilkinson, this English actor who we probably don't recognize, but Tom was in The Full Monty. Tom was also in The Patriot, and Tom was also played a pivotal role in the film called The Priest. So he's been around. He's a Royal Shakespeareanly trained actor, but we really don't know who he is. So
he came out of nowhere to me as a name.
As a name, that's right. He came out of nowhere. He's been doing very, very well in England. He had a big show there. But he plays a really nice, likable father in the bedroom. He's a doctor. He's got a great wife. He's got a great son. His son is having an affair with a local woman. But tragedy hits, and he has to respond in some way, and that is the real problem that he faces, and that is where the drama comes in his role.
She's not divorced yet, you know.
It's the same thing. Maine has crazy laws, that's all. Anyway, he loves her boys.
Oh, God, you don't think he wants to?
Oh, he's not going to marry her.
Well, then what's he doing with her?
She probably loves him. Girls always have. Let's just leave it at that.
So very real life with Tom Wilkinson in the bedroom.
Yeah, you know what I liked mostly about this film, though, and what he brought to it is that the vision that you find in small New England towns between the townies and the kind of middle-class yuppies, and he really did a good job of etching that out for us.
Sean Penn, we're accustomed to seeing him in tough guy roles. Here, something really different.
Yeah, again, a very different role for him. He plays a loving father. He has two problems. One, he has a 7-year-old daughter, which as any father would know, that's always a little bit of a problem. And the second problem is that he has the mind of a 7-year-old, and his child is taken away because they feel that he's an unfit father. He has to go look for a lawyer, and what better lawyer he could possibly find than Michelle Pfeiffer. And together, they start meeting, and Michelle finally takes him on.
If you get in touch with your friend, because I need legal advice now. You said I couldn't afford you, so I have to talk to somebody.
Yes, that's why I told you I would be your lawyer pro bono.
I don't understand exactly what you mean. You told me that you would be my lawyer.
Yes, Sam, I'm your...
Golly, because I thought I must have misunderstood you.
I told you that when we first met.
You said you would be my lawyer?
Yes. Sam,
You're my lawyer! You're my lawyer!
Yes, that's right, I'm your
okay,
lawyer.
Okay, and I can pay you per hour.
No.
On the hour.
Pro bono, it's free.
My lawyer for free.
Sean Penn is a mentally retarded father right here on the nominees list.
That's right. And the Academy tends to like these kinds of roles when you take a look at it. You know, Dustin Hoffman in Rain Man, Cliff Robertson in Charlie, even the single father thing, Dustin Hoffman again in Kramer versus Kramer. But I think this might be a little bit too much for Hollywood to take because you got some other really good candidates coming up.
Well, there's Will Smith, and of course he's in Ali, a name bigger than any name among these nominees. Is it Ali that puts Will Smith on this list, or is it his own performance?
Oh, it is definitely his performance. I mean, I was surprised at how good Will Smith is. He bulked up for this. He worked on it. He was totally, totally committed. And the thing that was really good was he worked very, very hard, and he ended up capturing Ali's ability to talk, the way that he patterns his words, and the way that he speaks in rhyme.
I ain't draft dodging, I ain't burning no flag, and I ain't running to Canada. I'm staying right here. You want to send me to jail? Fine, you go right ahead. I've been in jail for 400 years. I could be there for 4 or 5 more. But I ain't going no 10,000 miles to help murder and kill other poor people. If I want to die, I'll die right here, right now, fighting you. If I want to die... You my enemy, not no Chinese, no Viet Cong, no Japanese. You my poser when I want freedom. You my poser when I want justice. You my poser when I want equality. Want me to go somewhere and fight for you? You won't even stand up for me right here in America, for my rights and my religious beliefs.
Will Smith in Ali, he's got the rhythm right down. Is he a contender in this lineup?
You know, I think he is a contender. The only problem that I see with this is the film is not that good. The film is a solid film, but Michael Mann directed, and it's a little cold. And when you have someone as passionate as Muhammad Ali, you would expect it to be more passionate, and it's a little dispassionate. But I think that what this role has proven to everybody is that Will is a serious actor, and if he does another performance like this, he's going to be in the running again. I don't think he's going to make it, though.
Because everybody knows that Denzel Washington is a serious actor and can really deliver the goods, but he's up with something a little different this year.
Yeah, he is up with something different. And again, the Academy likes what he has done with this role. He's playing against type. I mean, is there anyone cooler on the screen than Denzel Washington? I think he's the coolest guy out there. And he always plays a good guy. He always plays a guy that is moral. But when it gets down to when he plays Alonzo Harris in Training Day, he plays one bad Machiavellian cop, and he plays it for all that it is worth.
Bad news, dog. Had lunch with the wise men today. They said you got to render under Caesar.
Vampires want my pension.
Nah, it's nothing like that. They just want to tax you a little bit. You know, they got their bolts and mistresses and, you know, house payments. Nothing I can do about it, you know? They're making me do it. I'm just a lowly civil servant.
You're their bitch. What happens to me?
I got your back, bro. I promise you, you'll never have to go back to prison. You ain't gonna miss what we take. I'm sorry, orders is orders, dog.
No, you ain't, cop.
Tim, Jeff, Jake, we're gonna work in the kitchen. Grab the tools. You guys hold them down.
Denzel Washington, not the way we're used to Denzel Washington. And is that what lands him on the list because he's doing something out of character here? Does the Academy like when the actor or actress turns it around and shows a new face?
Oh, sure. That happens a lot. I mean, one of my favorite little bits of trivia is that Donna Reed, you know, the quintessential mom, won an Oscar when she was playing in For Here to Eternity by playing a bad girl prostitute. So, yes, Hollywood does like that. But Denzel Washington's performance is definitely Oscar caliber. He's an incredible actor, and I like this role performance a lot.
Russell Crowe seems to be everywhere. He's in the air these days. It's not the first time he's been on the list. It's not the first time he will have won if he takes a trophy this year. How does it look for Russell Crowe in Beautiful Mind?
This is the third time he's been nominated in a row. Last guy that did that was William Hurt. The last guy to win two in a row was Tom Hanks. So if he wins this year and he's got a really good shot at doing that, he'll be the first one to top Tom Hanks. Now, in the last 6 years, the Screen Actors Guild winner has gone on to win the Oscar for Best Actor. And this performance by Russell Crowe is, again, a chance that we see him in a different way. He's not the big Hulk that he was in Gladiator. He is a very gentle, troubled soul trying to figure out what is going on within his mind.
I'm trying to solve the Riemann hypothesis.
Uh-huh.
I figured if I dazzle them, they will have to reinstate me. Well, it's difficult with medication because it's hard to see the solution.
You know, John, you should go easy. There are other things besides work.
What are they?
Russell Crowe in an amazing story in a very affecting role that he played there. All the more affecting, I guess, because we've seen him in the, as you say, the muscular gladiator stuff in the past. And here he comes out turning it all around.
Yeah, he turns it all around. I do think that there's a problem in Hollywood right now where there's a lot of whispering going on about his role where it has been damaged by the fact that it's not a true-to-life picture and that there have been some anti-Semitic...
True-to-life of the story of John Nash, the academic it's based on.
Yeah. So I'm not sure where it is going to end up going, but it is a great performance, and I think that Russell Crowe will end up at least getting several nominations in the future as well.
And your pick, where do you come down, Garen Daly?
I'm coming down with the coolest guy in Hollywood, Denzel Washington.
All right, we'll vote for that. Garen, thanks for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
Garen Daly is a movie reviewer and critic, the owner of the Dedham Community Theater in Dedham, Massachusetts, and On Point's movie maven. You can read more of Garen Daly's Academy Awards previews at our website. The address is onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're